Hiya, Tim here, and before the podcast, I have a quick note. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for the podcast. Every song is taken from Chic's Risqué. All tracks are written by Bernard Edwards and Nile Rodgers. It was released on the 30th of July, 1979, on Atlantic. Enjoy.
Where real music matters.
Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.
Hi, I'm Tim Burgess and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. If it's your first time listening, this is a show where I sit down with an artist going through a classic album and hearing the stories behind it. I've had so many enjoyable conversations with guests from Kinks to Keane, from Sleeper to Catatonia. To catch up any of these episodes, just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts to discover a whole archive of past listening parties. Just like Tim's Twitter listening party, a huge part of this is your involvement. So please get involved on social media throughout the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party and check out at Tim_Burgess and at Absolute Radio on X for more listening party content. This episode I'm joined by Nile Rodgers to talk about Chic's 1979 album, their third record, Risqué. Nile Rodgers, along with his band Chic's contribution to music cannot be underestimated. They are one of the most important artists in the popularisation of disco music in the 1970s. Nile Rodgers himself is one of the greatest guitar players of all time, with a unique style that he continues to lend to leading artists to this very day. He also remains a hugely in-demand record producer. His CV boasting credits on some of the biggest recordings from the likes of Daft Punk, Duran Duran, Madonna, David Bowie, Mick Jagger, INXS, the B-52s, Pharrell Williams, and so many more. I guarantee you'll have danced to a Nile Rodgers piece of work at some point in your lives, whether it be as an original work or given the fact that he and Chic are one of the most widely sampled artists in music. Their influence is enormous. He's a man full of incredible insight and stories, so let's get into the listening party. We would like to talk about Risqué.
Yeah.
Where were you at in life at this moment in time? Set the scene.
Okay, so Risqué was probably, I won't say the super highest point of my partying. I mean, you know, look, when they talk about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the interesting thing about the disco world and that whole world of the late 70s and the early 80s is that it was a loving sex, drugs, and rock and roll world. Right. There was nothing in my life and in my world that was about abuse and things like that. Everything, it was all about kindness and love. It's funny, in my autobiography, I talk about how I used to hold forth in the women's bathroom at Studio 54, and not one woman ever, and I don't remember this, maybe one did, but I'm just saying that maybe the probability of one who was embarrassed asked me to leave, but I do not remember one woman ever asking me to leave the bathroom. And I said one, probably because I had a lot of coke and they wanted it free. But two, because the atmosphere was one of peace and calm.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of like her girlfriend or a person she knew, even though I was a total stranger. And that was around the time of the Risqué album. That was when I wrote Good Times.
Yeah.
And why did I write that song? Because it was a reflection of the culture that, though we were having the greatest financial recession in the history of America, the greatest ever since the Great Depression, mm-hmm. our lives seemed rosy and fantastic, and that's what art and music and dance can do. That can transform a situation that seems so down. I mean, look at kids all around the world living in the worst conditions, and they're out there playing football, and they're having the time of their lives, yeah. and they don't realize that the situation around them is horrible. They could barely eat. Their parents are being exploited. But that child's mind which is very much like people who go out to clubs and party. It's this wonderful escapist mechanism that we have.
Yeah.
That we could easily just change our mind. We could walk into a room and there could be a fire. We go like, well, let the fire happen over here. We're going to stand on this side of the room where it's really cool and everybody's dancing. And I wrote Good Times because that's how it felt. Regardless of what the political and economic situation was in America, which didn't affect me that much because I was sort of poor anyway, though I had written many hit records. Well, record companies were notorious for not paying us, and God knows it was just absurd. But we had an amazing time. Everything looked like we were billionaires. It just was so awesome. I use the words from Al Jolson's movie. In America, they call it the first talkie movie. And I say, you know, happy days are here again. I say, happy days are here again. The time is right for making friends. Let's get together. The stars are going to twinkle and shine this evening about a quarter to nine. I said, let's get together about a quarter to ten. Boy, I'm really being a creative artist there. And then tomorrow, let's all do it again. And it's just great. And it's a story of life that I saw around me. And that's how it was. I could go out every night of the week. I could do my job every day of the week, regardless of feeling exhausted or hungover or what have you. The inspiration of the people, the times, and the art form gave me the energy to get through life and have a damn good time. And when I wrote that song, I was with John Deacon from Queen, and we had just met. Of course, I knew of Queen.
Yeah.
I had no idea that the future would lead David and myself to Queen's studio in Switzerland, where we would wind up doing Let's Dance. But we were all one great musical collective, regardless of what the press seemed to say. Like, oh, the disco guys don't like the rock guys. It was like, please, give me a break. Like, you know, no, we all love each other. We get along great. So anyway, so John Deacon and I were hanging out at Studio 54. And this has happened to me twice that I can remember. I meet somebody and I say, hey, let's go to studio. They think I'm talking about going to the recording studio. I was talking about, let's go to Studio 54 and party all night. So he thought I was talking about going to the studio. Like, no, we stay at Studio 54 all night, get completely laid out and wasted.
Yeah.
Oh, and then I go to the studio. Yeah. No sleep, no nothing. Now we go, and I write this song called Good Times. Bernard Edwards, my bass player and partner, walks in the room. I had already written out the charts for all the guys in the band.
Yeah.
And I think that John thought that that was amazing, because probably rock and roll bands probably mainly just sit around and jam and stuff. With.
So was John in the studio with you?
Oh, totally.
Yeah, well, so he was watching while Bernard was playing. And
I always wondered how they were going to handle that in the Queen movie. It was like, no, my bro was sitting right there, like, you know. And it was cool. Like, they sort of skate around it in an interesting way, because he never got any Queen songs, right?
Yeah.
It was like, the other dudes got the Queen songs, but he comes in and has the big one, the masterpiece.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there, and I'm playing with the band, and we're going, dan 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 dan, and it's got a vibe.
Yeah.
But Bernard wasn't there yet. So he walks into the studio and he says to Bob Clearmountain, our engineer, he said, hey, what's that? And Bob said, I don't know, that's something Niall came up with last night. And he comes in, and typically the way Bernard and I work together as songwriting partners, we both copy each other's parts first. And then we veer off into what becomes our individual unique part.
Yeah.
But at first, he starts playing boom, 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 because the whole band is doing that. Boom, 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 boom. And then for some strange reason, I scream out, walk. Now, the reason wasn't that strange because we had been a band for many years and we had tried to walk and we had tried to do all sorts of other things through every song. So we just tried it this time.
Yeah.
So I screamed out, walk. And he went, boom, 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 boom. I was like, what? He jumped to the four chord before I got there. And I'm like going, dude, you don't do that. Like, we all get there together. We used to make fun of our drummer when Tony Townsend would do a drum fill and, like, speed up because they get all hyper. Yeah. And Bernard would always look at Tony and go, my man, you know, this ain't a race. You don't get points for getting to the one before us.
Wow.
So the fact that he jumped to the four chord before me and he goes, boop a doo 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 doo. And I went, oh, my God. And it just sounded like magic. And I screamed to Clear Mountain. I said, make it red. Make it red. And we just recorded it. One take later, wow. Good times.
Wow, wow, wow. God. Second track on the album is, I don't know, I mean, it's stunning, super slick, perfect second track to Good Times. It's called A Warm Summer Night.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, that's like so sampleable. I mean, I know that, you know, with Good Times, you know, you've had Beastie Boys, LL Cool J, De La Soul, all sort of like, you know, take your song and sort of like use it for futuristic songs, you know, more present day songs. But A Warm Summer Night, I mean, it's a track that you have to keep playing on repeat and repeat and repeat. For me, anyway. Can you tell me a little bit about that, please?
It's one of my favorite compositions. When I wrote that,
so good.
Living in New York and having a large portion of my family be Puerto Rican and from the islands, we're very island, you know, come on, slavery, we're island kind of people. And Lucy Martin, our singer at that time, she's also Puerto Rican. Mm-hmm. And it was just so sweet to just have basically an instrumental. See, that's how Chic started. We started doing instrumentals with only choruses. We didn't have verses. It was all about dance music. It was groove, just groove, groove, groove. Yeah. And we just go, everybody dance, clap hand. And we just groove, down, 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 down. Because people liked to listen to music back in the day.
Yeah.
So Warm Summer Night was homage to that beginning of Chic, and to have the Puerto Rican girl in our band go, te quiero, papi, was just so, it was like, damn, come on. and I didn't expect people to get it. Who cares? But for me, it was just beautiful to say, you know, could you love me tonight on a warm summer night?
Yeah.
It would be so nice, so nice. Te quiero, papi. It was like, damn, come on, baby. It's still one of my favorites.
I mean, tempo-wise, it's such a good contrast from Good Times.
Right,
You know, it's like, I don't know, you know, a lot of times when people are, you know, putting an album together, it's like banger, then banger, and then banger. I mean, this is obviously a different kind of vibe, you know, it's just like slow and long and just like, you know, just sexy. And I mean, obviously Good Times is the dance track and the one that everybody kind of remembers. But to me, there's something so backed up by, you know, track number two.
Yeah.
That kind of makes me happy.
And the strings.
The strings, are yeah. So orchestration.
Lovely and supportive. And you know, and that's the interesting thing about Chic Records. Strings, typically, I wrote them as sweetening. Mm-hmm. They were not the stars. The stars of Chic is the rhythm section.
Right.
But in Warm Summer Night, just the sweetening, the way that they surround you yeah. and caress you
yeah.
is very important. I mean, it's a love song, straight yeah, up. I'm not kidding. You know, could you love me tonight on a warm summer night? That's it.
It's beautiful.
It's that simple. Not more complicated than that.
Let's hear that second track from Risqué, A Warm Summer Night. Where did it all start?
It?
Yeah, you know, I mean, music for you.
Oh, I was a child.
Six, seven?
A prodigy. I wasn't a prodigy. I sucked. But music was part of the standardized, the regular American curriculum. Yeah. Therefore, I learned music at whatever level I happened to learn at. But the incredibly wonderful byproduct
yeah.
was that by the time I was 11 years old, because my parents were heroin addicts and we kept moving from school to school to school, I never stayed in one school longer than maybe a month. So by the time I was 11, they always assigned you the instrument that was lacking in the symphony orchestra because we all sucked. It didn't make any difference. But by the time I was 11, I knew how every instrument functioned. And I could orchestrate, and hence when disco happened, I wrote everything. Wow. I did, like, when you see David Bowie go, wow, those horn arrangements Nile did were amazing. Like, unbelievable. It was like, yeah, because you don't know rock and roll guys who can, like, write horn arrangements like that. It's just normal for me.
So, you know, every school that you went to, they figured
the
that they...
The schools.
Oh, the schools.
Multitudes of schools.
Yeah, they all needed...
Something different. Right, so if I got to one school, I'd play open hole flute. Yeah. I had asthma.
Nice.
That sucked. Next school, oh, hey, give the kid a closed hole flute. Maybe he can do that. Oh, great. That's good.
Nice.
Oh, hi. Give the kid a trumpet trombone. Well, that's actually a very rare instrument. Yeah, but we have this one piece we're playing this year. Okay. So I knew the ranges of all the instruments and how they function. It was great. I mean, so, you know, when the Beatles became popular, there was a new term in music called the self-contained band.
Yeah.
Well, tell it to a kid. To us, that means you do everything. We had no idea. They didn't do orchestration. They just, you know, I read the news today. Oh, boy, there's some other genius doing all the orchestration. They're doing the main part, but, you know.
Yeah.
So we thought that we had to do everything. So we go and we do our first record.
And when you say we, who were you with?
Chic. Yeah, okay. No one could believe that we did everything.
Yeah.
I wrote my first pop song, Everybody Dance.
Yeah.
And I did everything. Strings, horns. We're like, how do you do that? Because in America, you have one person who's the string orchestrator, one person who's the horn orchestrator, one person does the background.
Uh-huh.
I did everything.
Wow.
So that's how I became me.
This is...
That was the interview. Thank you, guys. Really nice to meet you. Leo, cool. Love you, bro.
So this show is called The Listening Party.
Mm-hmm.
And for a bit of context, it started out on Twitter during lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
We'd done 1300.
Mm-hmm.
The Great and the Good, Robbie Robertson, Kylie Minogue, Barry Gibb,
man.
Paul McCartney... Breeders, Nirvana,
done them all.
We've had them all, and people that you've probably heard of.
Mm-hmm.
we go through an album and talk about it track by track, context, where you were, what you were doing before the album, what happened after.
Oh, great.
The functionality of the last track, you know, the sort of like track four and how important that is, you know, just like real, cool. Sort of like, you know, really digging deep. And it's now become a radio show,
mm-hmm.
Obviously, and thanks for taking part. And we've had Kings of Leon, Fall Out Boy, Texas. Yeah. And recently we had a friend of yours. If you don't mind, I'd like to start with a playback of what this mystery guest was saying.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
I can't wait to hear this.
Tell Niall I said hi. He'll know me very, 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 very
yeah?
well.
What's the story? I mean,
my distant cousin owned a studio called The Power Station. I was the gopher. I was the coffee boy. And Niall, for all intents and purposes, owned Studio B.
Yeah.
It was Chic's studio.
It was his place, yeah.
And so when Bowie came in to do that album with Stevie Ray, I wasn't in the studio much. You know, I literally, my job was to go get the beer and the burgers.
Wow.
But I absolutely was there. I walked in and saw it. Niall will echo it for you.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
I watched through the window as Bowie and Freddie sang Under Pressure. That was mind-blowing.
Wow.
There was so much going on there, and I was just a kid. Crazy.
Yeah. Anything you'd like to say about that?
No, man. I love John. I adore him. He was the greatest at getting coffee.
He was the greatest tea boy.
And it was really, you know what was really amazing for me to watch John go from a person, as we used to call a gopher, to developing a fan base and an audience. And the next thing you know, we see girls hanging out in front of the studio. And it was like, wow. So this person was doing it exactly the way that I believe that it should be done.
Right.
That you have a regular job to pay your bills, and then you have another job to try and do your art form and create an audience and learn how to transmit your emotions and your artistic ideas and whatever they may be to people you don't know.
Yeah.
And that is what an artist does, right? We look to the depths of our souls and we create something from nothing for people that we will probably never see. And it's just unbelievable. And I watched John do that and I was like, wow, this is cool. I get to watch a guy do what we had heretofore been doing ourselves, but not realizing that we were accomplishing so much. And it was just great. And I love you, John, and that's really cool, man. You're awesome. And he was at one of my last really cool gigs with Prince.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Where was that?
It was down in the Caribbean in Turks and Caicos.
Oh, wow.
And I looked up, I said, check out this John standing over there. I was like,
track three, My Feet Keep Dancing.
There you go.
And there's like the tempo is kind of like, I don't know, it's odd. I don't know what's keeping the beat. I mean, obviously the rhythm section, but is it to me, it sounds like the vocals keep the time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's so much space in the verses and it's really seductive. And, of course, there's the tap dancers.
I never told this story before, ever.
Oh, good. We like that.
So I was a huge fan of the Tony Williams Lifetime. And Alan Holdsworth was the guitar player at that particular time.
Frank Zappa's favorite guitarist.
Yeah, John McLaughlin had left. And then my old teacher, Ted Dunbar, had left. And they had a song called Fred. And Fred would be this song that would go, ding, ding, ding. And I was like going, oh, I love that. Ding, ding, ding. So when I wrote My Feet Keep Dancing, it goes, dun, 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 bing, bing, ding, ding, ding. I snagged that ding, ding, ding. Those,
right. The
basically superimposing the intervals that were relevant to the harmony,
mm-hmm.
but doing them in a certain way where the voice leading made a new melody on top of the groove. And the chord changes, I mean, you know, it's funny, man. I always sound like I'm a jerk because I know that most guitar players, they learn guitar players by a guy coming over going, hey man, show me how to play a G chord. Hey man, show me how to play. They don't typically understand tertiary harmony the way that jazz and classical guys do. So when you hear a song like My Feet Keep Dancing, and the first chord is a minor seven with a raised five, or as my band members like to interpret it, as a flat six. And the reason why I think of it as a raised five is because the mode that we're going to attack the song in, to just go boom, 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 ding, 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 ding. It was like you get to play jazz and dance music at the same time. And then our heroes, the Nicholas brothers, mm-hmm. Bob Clearmountain and I, we went out to Los Angeles. And as we were driving to the studio, I'm saying to him, I said, Bob, you know, I want the Nicholas brothers to tap dance on this song. He's like, what? I said, yeah, I want them to tap dance on the break. And we get to Kendon Studios and we set up these boards and they start tap dancing. And one of them has a heart attack in the middle of the tap dancing. I was like, oh no, how do we finish the routine? So we had the other brother overdub, and it just shows you how professional musicians are, because now his brother had a heart attack. We got to rush him to the hospital, but he's got a gig to do. So he finishes the job. You know, Chic Records, we don't record with click tracks, right? So, you know, you could feel it go a little bit out of the pocket and we fade it away.
Yeah.
But that's really historical, groundbreaking stuff for black artists. We didn't get a chance to do things on that level. And the only thing that allowed us to do it is the fact that we had already recorded the biggest selling single in the history of Atlantic Records. So
you made the record at Power Station, but you went to Los Angeles to get some other bits then, or... You know,
we went to L.A. to do the dancing with the... Because, believe it or not, they were not coming to New York.
No, so. they were quite old, right?
They were older, yes.
So, that's a great story. And then you mixed it all at Power Station.
Yeah.
Here's the third song from Risqué. This is My Feet Keep Dancing on Absolute Radio. Obviously, Chic changed a lot of things in music and sort of 70s. For me, while I was making notes, I was thinking, well, in the 80s, you made this record, pretty sure. It would have been the 80s, 82, Carly Simon, Why.
Yes.
Yeah, and I was dancing to that in 1987, every weekend at the Hacienda,
mm-hmm.
Manchester. You'd made, I think, the number one record for Studio 54.
Yes.
Le Freak.
The number one record for Atlantic Records, not just...
Oh, the number one record for... Well, I mean, it was a very heavily played record in Studio 54. and Atlantic Records, yeah. So, I mean, how does it feel to have, like, you know, people dancing, like you were saying about, you know, your story about John?
Yeah.
No, you know, you don't know these people, but they're dancing to your music and, you know, all over the world. And I mean, it must be kind of like quite a trip.
It's amazing. It's something that as a child I fantasized about.
Yeah.
But of course I couldn't comprehend. Well, I was pretty smart. I couldn't comprehend the numbers that would actually consume.
Yeah,
I could comprehend the numbers of the people on the planet because, of course, in school they go, well, yes, this year there's 5 billion people, whatever they would say. But I certainly never imagined those multitudes of people having some relationship to a piece of music that I'm making in my bedroom, just sitting on the edge of my bed with my manuscript paper going, okay, we're going to put a D minor 11, oh my God, and then put the four in the bass. How cool would that be? Because now Bernard gets to go do, 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 like, whoa. You know, it's, so it was just like an incredibly, at this point in my life, which is weird, right? Because I'm 72 years old, my gigs are 10 times as exciting as they used to be because now I have way more hits than I could have ever imagined. Yeah. And we play them. It's exciting. I have no boundaries. Like, I could run out in the audience. I could do whatever I want because we have wireless gear, which we've had from the very first Chic show. And by being able to touch people physically and talk to them and bring them on stage and do whatever, and that's just such a magical thing because this world is in such disarray and people are afraid of people and they dislike you for whatever silly reason. Like, you know, I like spaghetti. Oh God, you eat spaghetti, I hate you. You know, I was like, what are you talking about? Yeah. I mean, we have this wacky, I mean, think about this. We are all intelligent people, right? We've all been very well educated. And somehow the populace has been reduced to this way of thinking that I need to dislike you or find a problem with you because of something absurd. Like something that will never even touch their lives. Like, I hate gay people. Do you know any gay people? I saw RuPaul on TV. Oh, right. You hate him? you hate him? I used to watch Archie Bunker on TV, and I loved him. He was a character. He's playing a character. It's funny. I wish that the love and the vibe that we feel at our concerts, somehow those people could take that back to their people and say, I was just at this show this weekend and these guys were playing Like a Virgin, Everybody Dance, Let's Dance, Give Me Your Love, blah, 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 all these hit songs, and everybody was hugging and dancing and having a good time. Yeah. What if we did that? It's like, how about that as an idea instead of like disliking somebody because they wear green pants or a hoodie or something stupid?
I mean, that's one thing about dance music and, you know, playing shows and stuff like that. It brings just all the haters together in one space.
That's why I chose dance music. I was a jazz snob, so maybe on some wacky way I was similar to those people who hate people just because of an idea, like a silly idea. And the idea is as ludicrous can be.
Yeah.
All of a sudden I go into a disco and I see all these disparate people having the time of their lives. Yeah. And I'm going, why would I not want to be a part of that? Like, here's sadness and here's ultimate happiness. I think I'm going to choose ultimate happiness.
Niall, I think it's a great sentiment. Track 4 is My Forbidden Lover.
Mm-hmm.
Such a big single.
Yeah.
One of the best, right?
Yeah, My Forbidden Lover. Once again, another song with the good old raised 5 chord in it. And typically, the reason why I would use those type of harmonic progressions is because by having that one note stick out in the voice leading, it would allow me to build my chords in almost all fourths. So there would be this sort of beautiful undercurrent that you didn't quite know why it sounded pretty.
Right.
It just would sound pretty.
Yeah.
And then we get back to the real deal, to the minor 7 and the major, whatever. But that song about the strings doing the very staccato, it would just keep in the pulse. Once again, They're not the feature, but at that point, we wanted them, when we would do the live show, we love it when we would make them stand up and they would just go and be in the groove. My Forbidden Lover was, in a strange way, a sad song. It was two sad songs that I had written at that time because I was in love with a girl at the time, and then I'd meet their best friend and go, oh my God, she's amazing. Like, wow. The song on the second album, I Want Your Love, my girlfriend was this beautiful, wonderful artist named Nefertiti. And Nefertiti had a friend named Michelle Ali. So there were these two really cool black hip girls that were like in the scene and Studio 54. And Nefertiti and I were really thrilled and happy until one day she has a party and this girl, Michelle, shows up. And I go, whoa, who is that? Because as I said, this was during the time of sex, drugs, rock and roll. Well, my girlfriend at the time was, believe it or not, my product manager at the record label. And she was married, and she was married for like 80 gazillion years. And it was like, ugh, everything was clandestine and undercover. And so I wrote, My Forbidden Lover, I Don't Want No Other. Because we were a really important couple. We were together for over a decade whilst she was married. And I even went to her stepdaughter's graduation at Harvard and the whole bit. So it was like she was my family and my girlfriend. Yeah. But how did her husband not know it? Because he was one of the wealthiest people in New York City. It was like, so that means that he probably had a whole life going on over there. And it was just that world of the 70s. And you think about the whole sexual revolution and the Masters and Johnson era and Playboy magazine and stuff. And we talked about open sex and women's right to have abortions and things like that as intellectuals and also as people who cared. My mom almost died from three coat hanger abortions.
Oh my God.
We were people who cared. Like, why does a woman have to go through that when it could be safe? If guys had to go through that, I guarantee you the law would be changed like that. Mm-hmm. But this is a very open-minded kind of world. And if you didn't participate, big deal. So you didn't. No one made you, which is the reason why I'm so disturbed about this current world, because we all think other people's ways of lives are our problem, which, like, that's the most absurd thing. Like, if you drive a Volvo, I don't care. Like, that's your choice. If you, you know, like ravioli, that's, like, that's fine. I don't have to eat it if I don't like it. Why would I be off and have a movement? We're gonna burn down your house if we don't like ravioli. Like, what do you, you idiots? It's like, and the reason why I reduce it to such elementary type of thinking, because it's elementary, childish, it's not intellectual, it's not, well, the GDP of a man, no, it's just because you're damn racist and you want to be able to pick on somebody easy. And I know, because when I was a kid, just because I was different, people would pick on me because it was easy. It was like not, it wasn't some complex thing. It was just like, look at that guy. Look at that skinny black kid. Let's go beat him up. They didn't sit around and go, there's that skinny black kid. Let's beat him up. Well, you know, they're talking about the nuclear arms treaty. And please, we're talking about non-Euclidean geometry and maybe fractal geometry in the future. And it was like, no, it was just, he's black, he's skinny, let's beat him up.
Oh, my God. Well, now it's time for a song. This is track 4, opening side 2 of Risqué, My Forbidden Lover.
I don't want no other.
Is it a myth that you always start a song with a chorus?
That I always start a song with a chorus?
Yeah.
It's not a myth.
It's the truth?
It's the truth, but it's not dogmatic. It's not like every single song, but I would say 95% of my songs.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, yesterday I made a record with Burna Boy. Three records. Smoking. Just absolutely smoking.
Wow. Like, there you go.
And I loved it, and they were saying, God damn, we've never seen anyone write that fast. I'm like, going, I'm 72 years old. I've been doing this a long time. And I still feel young, so let's go. Three songs like that. The rest of the time we're just talking about the world. It was really cool working with Burner's producer, and he had a little beat. And I said, no, man, let's start it like this. And he was like, oh, that's so cool. And then he wound up, like, editing my lick at the top, so it had an intro,
yeah,
but it was basically the chorus building to the chorus.
You know, the chorus building to the chorus, right.
It was like a breakdown chorus building to the final payoff,
nice,
and then we go into the song. You know, man, that's the pleasure of working on art of any type, but because my specialty is music, it's just wonderful, man, to walk into a room, person you never met before, and there's that connection, and it's smoking.
And like, how do you feel when you walk in? Do you still get the kind of, like, you know, it's, there's like, I mean, for me, I love meeting musicians, and I kind of get a sort of tingle, and it's like a little bit like butterflies, and then you've made the connection, and it's actually just gets smoother and smoother and smoother as the day goes along.
Right.
I mean, that's the way I feel, and it's like, you know, there's excitement, intrepidation, all those magical sort of things, you know. And
yeah, no, it's great, man. Yesterday I was at Abbey Road, so I pretty much know everybody, and if I don't know them, I want to meet them.
Yeah, cool.
So I say, okay, so who's in, you know, Studio 2? Okay, they're doing a big orchestral score for so-and-so. I said, well, who's the composer? Simon, somebody. I said, I don't know him, but I want to walk in and meet him. And because I walk in, all the musicians know me because I've worked on big classical scores. And, you know, so it was fun. And then I went upstairs and I met James.
James Blake, right?
And I was like, going, whoa, dude. I said, do you know one of my favorite songs of all time is, and like, he's sitting there and he's like wondering what I'm gonna do, and I start singing, I said, Retrograde. I said, how the hell did you think of humming through that song as a loop, like, right, you just hummed all the way through it? And I just love, you know, show me how you're strong, love anybody else, or you alone now, whatever, because he's got an incredible voice.
Yeah.
I had no idea that dude could sing like that, and I'm trying to imitate him, and I suck. And it was great. He was so flattered, and I was so happy to meet him. It's like, dude, you're the man. So it was just great.
It feels like home, then, Abbey Road, even though, you know, I don't know how many times you've, you know, worked there, but...
Yeah,
As a studio, it has that feeling, doesn't it?
Creative director for now, almost 3 years running, and
it's been great. Yeah.
You know, being able to bring in younger musicians, being able to bring in people like Bruno Mars, Anderson .Paak, the Sultans, who are now doing pretty well with the new album we just finished.
We had them on here, yeah.
I hope they say good things about me, because we had a blast.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about another mutual friend of ours, Johnny Marr.
Mm-hmm. Ah,
yeah,
my brother.
Yeah. And you know, obviously, you talk about everything. But do you talk about guitars a lot?
Not a lot.
No.
Composition and vibe.
Yeah.
And we talk about the things that we like. That we have in common. And most people, because Johnny comes from this, what looks like this sort of like very dirty, punkish kind of post-punk,
Manchester,
whatever you want to call it, Manchester, and, you know, vibe. And see, that's funny. They think musicians are like all one-dimensional.
I know.
So the very first time Johnny Marr walked up on stage with me and played, we played Hamilton Bohannon foot stomping music.
Wow, that's a great one.
Foot stomping music. And he was into it. Foot stomping music. And then he told me that when his son Niall was born, he didn't allow Niall to listen to anything until he heard Chic. He covered his ears, ran the baby out to the car, and turned on a Chic song and said, I wanted the first song you hear in your life to be a Nile Rodgers song. I was blown away.
You can really hear it in his playing.
Yeah.
That he was definitely inspired by you, and obviously calling his son Nile.
It's like, okay, Johnny, can you pay me?
I asked him down to come and play on a Charlatans record. He came down, started playing, and then said, okay, that's it. And it was amazing, you know, as he often is, like, first take, you know, always his first take. Ended up playing on four songs within about, I don't know, 3 hours or something
right,
like that.
Yeah, it's just
like,
great.
Well, man, yeah, still got it. You're listening to Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. Here's Chic with Can't Stand to Love You. We can get a straight story. Little pup, do it for me, or I'll number your day. Can't Stand to Love You by Chic on Absolute Radio. Niall, tell me about that last song.
Mm-hmm. So we were a band. We were pretty good people, but, you know, sometimes you wind up falling in love or falling in like with the girls in your band. Mm-hmm. And we had more girls in Chic than we had guys. So we had 3 girls on violin. We had 2 girls on horns. We had 2 girls singing with us. And then when Luther Vandross was with us.
Alpha?
We had Alpha and Lucy. Those are the main stars. But people don't realize that if you look at the album credits, you'll see Luther Vandross, and he would have girls with him. So at some point in time, you wind up becoming close, and you go out with one girl, and next thing you know, you're going out with a different one, and it was just, you know, it's like, I can't stand to love you, because it creates a little bit of tension in the band.
Yeah.
The great thing about Chic is that it never created that much tension, because we all liked each other, and we were all kind people.
Yeah.
The thing that got bad was near the end, where drugs made you start to see the world in a perspective that wasn't actually accurate.
Right, right.
So you could get angry about something that would no longer be a relevant topic to be angry about. But for some reason, because you were all lit up on coke, you'd all off. And so Can't Stand to Love You was a song about the inner actions and workings of Chic. And we didn't really write about ourselves that much, but that particular song and that album. So when you get it, when you say, like, when you hear this song, will you cry?
Yeah.
And
that was such a heartbreaking song.
Because at that point, Bernard and I were going out with Lucy and Alpha, and then we had switched. And so Lucy sings that song, and she goes, love is pain, and pain is, I don't want to get into it.
That's very Fleetwood Mac and Rolling Stones, isn't it?
Well, it goes, love is pain, and pain could be pleasure. If you know, it's like, well, but now it's your turn to cry.
It's a heartbreaking, man.
Yeah, it's really, and it's just so beautiful. And one of the greatest moments of my life was a band that I idolized, the Isley Brothers.
Oh, I love the Isley Brothers.
And I was like, whoa, the Isley Brothers are covering Chic.
Amazing. Let's hear the penultimate track on Risqué. Will you cry when you hear this song? Actually, it's will you cry, open brackets, when you hear this song, close brackets. Thank you. That was Chic with Will You Cry, open brackets when you hear the song, close brackets, on Tim's Listening Party. Nile Rodgers still joins me, going through Chic's 1979 album, Risqué. What about the cover? I'm intrigued by the cover. You know, it's kind of like, looks kind of like old times, black and white photo.
That was the whole point.
And it is a piano, right, on the cover?
Yeah.
Okay, so where was that?
It's basically what we did is we built a set that was like an Agatha Christie novel. It was like, okay, the butler did it. So you see Bernard, he's got a knife stuck in his back and he's lying on the piano.
Yeah.
And then on the next picture, we're all happy, like, hey, whatever, you know. It's like, who killed Bernard Edwards? Like, what's going on here? And what was really interesting about that cover, which we were allowed to do because we had just recorded the biggest selling hit.
Yeah, great.
Now money was no object.
Yeah, that freedom.
Every single thing that you see in that shot is authentic. All came from museums, all came from big private collections, and every single artifact was the real deal. There was no, like, fake, you know, books. It was like, nope, it had to come from the Carnegie Collection. It had to come from the Museum of Modern Art. And, you know, it's like they let us borrow that stuff. And
Beautiful. That's
valuable.
Yeah.
If one thing had gotten ruined, it'd be gone.
You must have felt so good to be able to do that, you know, for your album sleeve, you know.
To be a black artist in America and to have that type of artistic freedom where we could talk about the Nicholas Brothers, that's why we had them dancing on it. Yeah. That's why we did the cover in black and white.
Yeah.
We knew that our history and our present and our future was connected to Cab Calloway and John Coltrane and Nina Simone and Lena Horne and all those people.
Beautiful.
We didn't want to show them all on the cover like Sgt. Pepper or something like that, but we felt, just as artists, we knew in our hearts, if other people didn't get it, it's okay. But sometimes as an artist, you have to live for the reality that you know exists and you commit to it.
Yeah.
A very famous, wonderful actor and activist and a great man named Harry Belafonte sat me down one day when I was in the Black Panthers, and he looked at me and he says, artists are the gatekeepers of truth. What we did with that album cover is we were showing you the truth, that in order for us to be who we are and sell the biggest selling we had to have John Coltrane, we had to have Cab Calloway, we had to have Lena Horne, we had to have James Brown,
we had to
have all these people.
Yeah.
So how do we show that? We show these books that are first edition books, and we said, what were they known for? They were known for entertainment. They were just side characters in films. They were never the stars. So we were just playing the sort of side characters, maybe the butler did it kind of thing. It was just, you know, a complete artistic concept, and we were paying homage to our heroes.
I love it. Amazing. What a story. Your friend John Bon Jovi said that he wrote a lot of Slippery When Wet by a fridge in his apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard you talk about, like, you know, writing songs in your apartment. Is there anywhere in particular that you like to write?
No. I just walk around with the guitar.
Yeah.
The only thing that I used to think about was the bed, because I had, you know, a pile of manuscript paper just sitting next to the bed.
Yeah.
And that's a very powerful vision for me. When I did Let's Dance, same thing. I went to Switzerland. I'm at Bowie's house, and I just had a pile of manuscript paper next to the bed, because I figured if he walked in with an idea, I wanted to be able to capture it, because we didn't have these cell phones and
we couldn't record right away.
I guess we had like little cheap cassette players, but it just wasn't my vibe. I was a jazz classical guy. Like, no, I want to write it out because I want to get the harmonic structure exactly right and the voice leading going to the next chords. So, you know, that was my thing. I just carried manuscript paper around with me. And it was usually right next to the bed because I don't sleep very well. Mm-hmm. And I watch television all night, and it's somewhat illuminated in the corner, the manuscript paper. And if I'm watching a movie and I hear a lick, and I go, oh, wait a minute, that's a cool idea. Let me write this down. So, yeah, and I don't have any place more special than the bed.
The last song on the album, this classic album, What About Me?
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about choosing the last track?
So typically in those days, because we were limited by vinyl,
yeah,
by what
the length,
the bass response and yeah, blah, 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 and the grooves, yeah, and the depth of the groove. Yeah. And, you know, so we had to lay out our albums like films.
Yeah.
And that's what was really important to us. We would create a film, and the singles were the trailers.
Yeah.
Those were the things that made you want to see the complete film. So we would lay it out, and I go, this is the end. And here's the beginning, the middle, and end. All of our albums had beginnings, middle, and ends.
Let's hear that final song from Risqué, What About Me? What About Me by Chic, concluding their album Risqué on The Listening Party. Now, a few final questions from me. So, you worked with all the great and the good. Madonna being a favourite of mine.
Yeah.
I'm a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And I play in a band called The Charlatans. And I had the chance of meeting Madonna, and I really blew it. We played at the Limelight,
mm-hmm,
in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And she came backstage, and I was in a bit of a right old mess. It's a regrettable moment. I was kind of lying in a deli tray.
Mm-hmm.
And she walked through, and I was really looking forward to meeting her, and all she said was gross. And which I kind of like that as a punchline of the story. However, you know, I was like, you know, I just have had so many things to say,
right,
to her. And you know, I was in my drug days, mm-hmm, basically. So
yeah,
we all were. Yeah, I was, so I mean, I figured that she'd seem worse, but
she had.
Yeah, going back to the musician bit.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping that you could play the guitar for me.
I actually left my guitar in the car. I said to the driver, I said, do you think I need to bring my guitar upstairs? They said, nah. I said, okay, great.
I said to you that I have a guitar.
Oh, you do? Probably I won't like yours, but let me see if I do.
Okay. Obviously, no pressure.
No. I don't mind pressure. The thing that you have to learn about me is I don't mind sucking because inherently I know I'm pretty good.
I think the whole world knows that.
It looks cool. Oh, it looks really cool. Oh, it's a fox. Wow. Oh, it looks very, very, very cool.
And I was thinking, you know, I mean,
I love the fact that it's white.
Yes, I thought you might like that.
A chrome pick guard. Hey, pal, you're like ripping me off here. What's going on, man?
I mean, I'm guessing that the Hitmaker's locked up in Fort Knox. It's pretty good.
How's
it feel? I mean,
it feels really good, man.
I love that guitar.
Really good.
I'm
shocked.
Really?
It feels really good.
Oh, I'm glad.
See, I grew up on jazz guitars, so what this is, the neck the radius and the width of the neck is actually quite comfortable.
Yeah.
It's very, very sort of Gibson-like in its construction.
Mm-hmm.
And the action is very nice. I love the fact you have light strings.
Yeah, thank you. The Hitmaker.
Yeah, it's cool.
Your guitar.
My guitar.
Yeah, I mean, is there just one?
There is just one.
Okay.
I mean, Fender is making new ones now. Oh, look at that, dude. Here's so much magic. The Hitmaker has a very, very thin headstock, just like you have right here.
Uh-huh.
It's a wee bit thinner than yours, but yours is very thin. If you look at a regular Stratocaster, you'll see that the headstock is, you know, thicker than this, and I cannot convince Fender to go like this.
Really?
And I try and explain to people that the mass of the guitar, though it may seem scientifically correct, and everybody will admit that the mass has a lot to do with it, to a player, that just little bit of difference makes all...
I can imagine.
It's everything.
Yeah.
Look at your head. That, man. People have to understand this is the big deal. Because what's happening is that the strings are resonating up the body. Okay, great. They're doing their thing there. But this thing here, for some reason, and I wish I understood mathematically why this very thin headstock makes that brightness happen when you're playing. But this is the magic.
It's got a really nasty sound, you know, like if you just plug it in, and you know, which I really like, and, you know, kind of... You know, that kind of 60s buzz, kind of thing.
This is awesome looking, man. This is cool. I didn't think that this would feel cool, but this is amazing to me.
My friend has one, and it is pretty much built around the same time, and it's completely different.
Like, what year is this?
I think it's 80s.
This is cool.
Well, we're going to wrap it up, but I would love to talk to you one day about Sister Sledge. We are family, and thinking of you in particular. And
how about Diana Ross?
I'm coming out. Just amazing, right?
How about Bowie? How about In Excess? How about Duran?
I would like to talk to you about all of those things, but I particularly with thinking of you.
Yeah.
I bought that when I was a punk. You know?
Right.
And it's just like, you know, musicians aren't linear, but I wasn't a musician then, you know, I mean, but I just think that it really resonated with me as a teenager growing up in Manchester.
Yeah. Manchester is happening, man.
Oh, yeah.
When we went to clubs in Manchester and we perform, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Off the scale.
And I just got to throw this out here.
Oh, please.
Manchester, it could be freezing in the winter time, and the girls are showing up at the clubs like almost half naked. I'm like, going, what? They're not wearing coats, they're wearing micro mini skirts. I'm like, going, I need to move to this place. This is incredible. Manchester is such a sexy, hip town, man.
There's always been links with New York, Manchester.
Oh, it's awesome, man.
Thank you so much, Niall.
Pleasure.
You've got to get on with your day now, I'm sure, but that, you know, it could have lasted for hours.
Yes.
Thanks to Niall Rogers for joining me on this episode of My Listening Party to tell me all about Chic's classic album, Risqué. If you've heard the show before, you know I like to end each episode by telling you about what I've been listening to recently. So, Madonna, the album Like a Virgin, but in particular, the track Angel, which is one of my favourites of hers. And it was produced by Niall Rogers. Also produced by Niall Rogers, a Bowie album called Let's Dance. So let's recommend Let's Dance. I know that Niall is friends with Johnny Marr, and I like to play Ask by the Smiths a lot lately for some reason. I don't know why, but it's great. Everything that Johnny does is great, but this is Johnny doing what he's great at. And Sister Sledge, you know, for me, We Are Family is just gorgeous, and that's Niles all over that one too. So Sister Sledge, a greatest hits would be something I've been listening to. And while we're talking about recommendations, why don't you recommend this show to a friend? Tell them to replay any previous listening parties by just searching and following Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll find a whole archive of listening parties with the likes of B-52s talking about making Cosmic a thing with the help of Nile Rodgers. You can hear the wonderfully chaotic chat that I had with Pete Doherty and Carl Barrett of the Libertines, and Jim Kerr and Charlie Birchall of Simple Minds talked through their 1982 record, New Gold Dream. Every song on this episode of my listening party was taken from Chic's Risqué. All tracks are written by Bernard Edwards and Nile Rodgers. The album was released on Atlantic. See you next time.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.